Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the tolerant city of Cambridge, my hometown, bans smoking in public housing. Is it one more step towards outlawing smoking everywhere? Then it's Callie Crossley and Who's More Crass, AIG's CEO who compared criticism of bankers' bonuses to lynchings in the Deep South, or Texas Senator Ted Cruz equating his critics with Nazi appeasers. And then three people jump on the subway tracks to save a fellow traveler. Would you? Would Marjorie? Would I?
Emily Rooney shares with us her world-famous weekly list of gripes and tells us about some really weird stuff happening at the once venerable Newsweek magazine. And then our Friday news quiz, a battle of the bulger experts with the Boston Globe's Shelley Murphy and the Boston Herald's Peter Galzinis. All that up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So this week is a good one for public health, but many would argue not so good for civil liberties. The Cambridge Housing Authority's commissioners voted on Wednesday to ban smoking in all city-owned public housing. That follows by about a year the implementation of a similar ban in Boston public housing. We want to know, is this another step toward banning smoking everywhere, as Marjorie believes
yes.
it is? Is this a movement you'd like to see gain more momentum, or is it going too far when it comes to people's individual freedoms? Our number is 877-301-8970. Now, I would like to say, Marjorie, before you misrepresent my position, because we've discussed smoking probably
many times,
a thousand times
Jim's
in the last 15
jihad.
Years. Here's my position. My position is in any multifamily dwelling, whether it's public housing, and I have sympathy for older people who are going to have to go outside 25 feet from the building to smoke.
No, you don't.
Or if you're in a condo association, you're in a triple decker. If your smoking affects kids who may live there or come by, other residents, then the reality just can't do it. You have to go outside. This is not an attempt to ban smoking everywhere. 877-301-8970. Do you support what the Cambridge Housing Authority did? Happens to be my hometown. Do you think, as Marjorie is about to explain, that it is a step towards, it's a sort of a backdoor way to begin the move towards banning smoking everywhere? And give us a buzz.
It is a backdoor move toward banning smoking everywhere.
Who supports
everywhere?
Banning smoking everywhere?
Well, I think you do, actually. I think if truth be told, if we had a little, what is the truth serum?
Sodium pentothal.
Sodium pentothal. We have some sodium pentothal here, Jim. The truth
well,
is,
we don't, do we?
You would ban smoking. You'd ban it in single family homes. Listen, nobody likes the smell of secondhand smoke, or the feel of secondhand smoke, and you certainly don't want kids affected by this. But this is public housing. Mm-hmm. These people don't exactly have many choices in their life. They have nowhere to go. Why not have a smoking section in public housing where the people that are recovering alcoholics or recovering drug addicts, a lot of people rely on cigarettes as the last legal vice and the thing that hasn't caused them, undue duress in their life. I mean, obviously there are health problems with it. This is poor people in public housing and old people and disabled people. They can't have a cigarette. Now, they do. That's what they're going to have to do. They're going to go out in the middle, and they're addicted, by the way.
What happens when the older person next door to you in the public housing has asthma or something
like that? I just said, let's have a smoking section. Let's segregate the people.
Marjorie, you know, the discussion you and I have had ad nauseum through the years, our number is 877-301-8970, for you to weigh in is, and you finally acknowledge this. We were talking about, I think it was hotels or something a couple of years ago. And finally, under duress, after I asked you for the 13th time, you admitted that if someone's smoking, for example, in their hotel room and they put a wet towel under the door, when you walk down the hallway, you still smell the smoke and it's still all over your clothes. This notion that there's an ability to segregate in one room and it doesn't go somewhere else is just fallacious.
There was a quote in one of these stories and I thought it really hit the nail on the head. This guy said, this is more about social control than protecting the life and health of the public. And I believe that. There's a certain finger wagging going on here. Well, you know, we have to have empathy for alcoholics. We have to have empathy for drug addicts. We have to have empathy for everybody except smokers. Smokers are the new pedophiles. And we can just kind of, it's true. I mean, we just treat them like pariahs. And, you know, they are addicted. I don't think most people want to keep smoking. They're addicted. They're trying.
Is this a ban on smoking or is it a ban on smoking in the physical
building?
It's not a ban on smoking. Go outside.
If you're 80 years old, from December to March, it might be a little risky going outside at 11 o'clock at night with the ice and the snow. You have to go 25 feet from the front door.
You do. Exactly.
So you got to get your overcoat on. And also, you may not be able to do that because you might be disabled. Nobody thinks smoking is any good now. We all know. But there's a finger wagging, nah, 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 here about smokers.
You know why? Because it kills people.
Oh, yeah.
And you know why? Because even the most conservative...
Yeah. Walking down the hall outside the... I mean, it may be awful because you can smell the smoke. I agree with you there. But walking down the hall
too.
To your apartment by the apartment that someone smokes in where you can smell it is not going to
kill
you. Can I
tell you something? Surgeons General, including for conservative presidents like George W. Bush's, acknowledge... I mean, there's no question... This is not an open question about the impact of secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke mm-hmm. isn't... They're not talking about... Let them smoke an e-cigarette. You like
yeah.
those things.
Well, there's a lot
Give
of people,
the seniors
there's
the people
a lot
in
of
public
people
housing.
Who spent their childhoods in the homes with smokers, who spent their childhoods driving around in cars with smokers, with all the windows closed, the whole place full of smoke, their apartments full of smoke. Their mothers were smoking when they were pregnant, and they're not all keeling over with emphysema and the terrible
Not all.
Diseases.
No, they're not. But you're not denying the health issues and the
yeah,
conclusive
I think if you,
health
I think
issues.
If you work for
not
20
everybody
years
dies
in
who
a
experiences
restaurant,
secondhand
that's
smoke.
That's right. I think if you work for 20 years in a restaurant where they were smoking, you got a big issue. If you're walking down the hall from an apartment and you're inconvenienced because for those two steps you're by the apartment, you smell cigarette smoke. I mean, these people
What if you
have
live
an
next
addiction.
Door? What if you live next door to that smoking room that
I
you
told
want
you,
to create?
We should have a smoking section.
What if you live next door to the smoking section? What do you do then?
Maybe they should put a little empty apartment between.
877. I know you don't know.
I think that people who are in public housing, who are poor people, who don't have a great situation to begin with, and they're old and they're disabled or they're recovering alcoholics, a lot of smokers. You ever go to an AAA meeting? Everybody's outside the AAA meeting smoking like a furnace with a Dunkin' Donuts coffee.
Okay.
Would you rather have them drinking or smoking?
Before we get to the calls, I want to say I want to preclude what Marjorie's going to come up with in a couple of minutes is, you know what Jim wants to do next? He wants to ban ice cream from public housing,
well,
too, because that's bad for your health.
But that's a different issue because, of course, you're not inflicting your ice cream eating on other people, although you are, of course, inflicting your ice cream cone eating on the public health system, which has to pay for obesity. And, by the way, obesity costs us more money in terms of public health than smoking does.
No, it's past smoking. 877-301-8970. What do you think about the Cambridge public housing vote? But there's also a larger question. Do you agree with Marjorie that this is yet more of the path on the so-called slippery slope towards far broader bans? And do you think the individual freedom issue outweighs the public health issue? I surely do not. Let's start in Beverly with Karen. Karen, you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for the call, Karen.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just got in my car and I heard you talking about this and I was like, oh my gosh, I got a call. I was forced to live in public housing in 2008, and I basically asked them not to put me in next to a smoker, and they said there was nothing they could do because I get very sick. And within 2 months, I had bronchitis, asthma. I had asthma, and my blood count went down 8 points, and I could not get out, and I had a very contentious neighbor who had a lot of issues, and I begged her I was going to lose my kids because I was so sick I couldn't work, and she just told me to move, and I was told if I moved that I had no choice, there would be somebody else there, and it almost killed me, and my daughter would wake up at 2 in the morning crying, Mommy, I just want a place to lay in my head that doesn't smell like smoke.
Karen, Marjorie's advice to you.
Okay,
said you should buck up, Karen.
Karen, you got me almost in tears here. Obviously, that's a very, very
compelling
story.
So what do you do, what do you do for Karen?
I went to my next-door neighbors telling them I'm going to lose my kids, and they said, well, then move.
But what about
Karen? Do you
hear
what they said?
What,
then move.
But Karen, what about the smoking section? I mean, because you know, most people don't like the fact that they smoke. Everybody knows it's terrible for you, but they're addicted to it. You know, I mean, it's not that easy to quit smoking.
Yeah,
somebody...
but the thing is, once it crosses into my lungs, they are violating my body.
Karen, I am so with you, and I hope
you're
better now.
They are violating my body, and I almost died from it. I had 8 emergency room visits because I couldn't breathe. I had needles stuck in me, and my neighbors would just laugh. And one of the neighbors, actually, they were very, very cruel. One of them, actually, the one who sat by my window and did it on purpose with my other neighbor, within 2 years, she had, because of smoking, she was dead. Okay.
And whatever. Hey, Karen, you make a very compelling case. I think this should end the whole discussion right here. Karen, thank you for the call. Seriously, you know, getting back to the smoking section thing, tell me a place you've been lately that's had a smoking section where no matter how far away you were from it, you didn't smell or feel the smoke. I mean, come on.
I think a lot
you walk
of people,
outside buildings that are no smoking buildings like ours is, and people are smoking outside.
A lot of people live in apartment buildings where some people smoke and some people don't. And a lot of condo associations are making rules about it. And I feel less sympathy for people in condo associations because they have the wherewithal to move. I mean, the thing that Karen pointed out, she was in public housing, and you're in public housing because you're down on your luck in terms of finances. And that's, I guess, what bothers me is that people that are in their duress because they're poor or they're don't have any money and have to live in public housing.
Marjorie,
I feel bad picking on them.
I feel bad for them too. Now, Marjorie,
I feel bad for Karen too. Obviously, with her health issues, that's why you should separate
Karen's,
them.
Yeah, but Karen isn't doing an affirmative act. She's just trying to breathe. Last year, at the end of the semester, I was driving my older daughter back from college in Western Mass.
Uh-huh.
We had a mattress on the roof of the car, and the mattress almost blew off twice. So we had to stay at a motel in Holyoke. We stayed in a hotel in Holyoke.
Well, that was your first mistake.
And I asked for a room, a non-smoke, well, the whole hotel is non-smoking. Oh, fine, give us any room.
Okay.
The room reeked of smoking. I went to the front desk, and I said to them, you gave us a smoking room. And you know what they said to me? They'd been a non-smoking hotel for 2 years. It it is everywhere. It intrudes into everything.
How much did the Holyoke Hotel cost you, Jim?
$39. It was not the finest.
Maybe,
it was a
maybe
flop
you should
house,
have driven to Springfield and gotten a slightly 877-301-8970.
The serious aspect of this is secondhand smoke is the real deal. I understand the freedom thing. And I have, by the way, I have sympathy too. When you read some of these.
Have any sympathy.
No, I do. I mean, particularly
older
people.
You think
it's gross
and disgusting and people should be shot at dawn.
No, I don't. People, older people in particular who are not that mobile, who are addicted to smoke, it's a real serious problem. Then they have to figure out a way to help them get 25 feet away from the building.
Oh, yeah. How are they going to do that? They're going to come carry them out in sedan chairs.
Well, how do they do anything
February?
Else? Whatever else they do, they get help with. They got to get help with that. And that should be part of the mix. Let's go to Alexander. You're in Gloucester. You're on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marty, we're talking about the vote of the Cambridge Housing Authority to ban smoking. Hey there, Alexander.
Hi. Earlier, Marjorie had a comment about people who grow up in houses where there's smoking by the parents, or they're in a car with the windows up.
Yes, where your mother was pregnant, smoking like a furnace.
Right, that's fine. But that being purely anecdotal, the evidence towards, the effects of secondhand smoke is pretty clear. Now, as far as public housing is concerned, and I have been, now no longer am, but have been in that situation, your income is very limited. And if you have any vices, you're actually subsidizing that vice by, allowing it to be there. It's not a matter of their right or their, having a heart and whether they want to go ahead and have a cigarette. It's just a matter of it's $10 a pack. So
is it $10 now?
It's pretty close.
It's easily
$10.
It's more.
Wow.
For premium brands. And so it's a matter of do you really want to subsidize $10, as much as that a day or more? That's $70 a week. What is that? That doesn't make any sense.
But Alexander, I would assume people that have very little money are compensating by giving up other things.
Yeah, but that's I'm not with you.
Maybe the smoking should be one of them.
Yeah, but Alexander, that's where you lose. My view is if people decide to spend money on something that's legal, even if I don't like the behavior, as long as the behavior doesn't affect me, they're entitled to waste all their money on whatever they want to waste
it
on.
It's true, and we see the lines at the lottery kiosk at every convenience store in the land, and at the end of the month, everyone blows their entire income on it.
And all ladies are buying I would argue that in some ways that ends up hurting us. But in any case, Alexander, thank you for your vote of confidence in my position.
I'm searching without luck through the email for someone who agrees with me.
We have a caller. We'll get to a caller in a minute who is with you. Gloria, you're in Uxbridge. You're on 96. What are you? You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Well, hi. How are you?
Excellent.
I called in the very beginning of this because I just wanted to say as much as typically, I agree with Marjorie's point of view, and in fact, you would almost call. I'm an NPR listener. I'm a public radio listener. I sympathize with the poor and the elderly and the addicted. But I think that it really is a simple cost benefit analysis, and in fact, I do agree that it's on the way to inhibiting civil liberties. But I think it's worth it, and I think that the analysis has been done on the cost benefit, of not allowing folks to dump toxins into their backyard because it seeps into the larger waterways.
Well, but Gloria, that's the point. I would argue that when the civil liberties of the smoker run up, and I think this is your point, against the civil liberties of the non-smoker, Karen, the first caller who was really moving, mm-hmm. that's where the line is crossed. I consider
exactly.
myself a major civil libertarian too, but
right, and there, but it's always going to be a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
We have to accept that. And like I said, we don't allow chemical waste to be spewed into the air and the water. And I think that this is just not that hard. And I recognize the difficulty of addiction, but I feel and I do sympathize with that. I grew up in public housing with smokers and smokers around me, and I don't smoke, and I'm lucky. But I understand that that's a very difficult break. But I think too bad.
Gloria, I'm with you. Thank you for the call. But by the way, the reason Marjorie didn't respond to Gloria is because she's furiously searching the email, as she said, for one.
I do have a couple.
Should we take a call who agrees
with? We'll take a caller. That's right.
Scott
we'll
Winchester,
Hi,
you
Scott.
Apparently are with Marjorie. Yes.
Thank God you called, Scott.
Jim, I'm your biggest fan, but I am solidly with Marjorie on this one.
Why is that?
Well, I'm going to preface it too by I'm also the first person who would never date anyone who smoked. I am still the person who will wag my finger at smokers. I harass family members who do. But I'm just not buying that somebody who lives in their unit and smokes within their unit creates such an exhaust of smoke that it just makes it unlivable for everybody else. I think... Yes, there may be some inconvenience. There may be some, I'm aware that somebody else is smoking. But I crossing that line of civil liberties and just taking away the ability to smoke in your own home.
Yeah, the home part.
Killing me.
Yeah, but Scott,
you know, we have an email that made the point that you're making, Scott, that it's one thing to smell smoke. It's another thing to inhale it. And just because you're smelling it doesn't mean you're inhaling
it.
Marjorie, it's another thing, too. It's not like being in a room full of smoke,
right.
In an airplane full of smoke or in a car full of smoke. It's being, okay, you notice it, so what?
Yeah, but Scott,
Karen's message was kind of tough.
Yeah, that is kind of tough. But Scott, thanks for the call.
Yeah, then it's different to smell it than inhale it.
What does that mean?
Because
of course
smelling
it's different.
It may be gross, and you think, ooh, that smells
so
horrible.
So if you smell something in the air, you're not
than
inhaling
breathing it?
Of course you're breathing. If you smell it, it's there, and you're breathing it.
No, I don't think that's true at all.
Of course it's true.
I don't think that's true at all. The smoke lingers in things. It lingers on. Anybody knows who goes to a bar and you used to be able to smoke in bars, you have to always wear washable stuff to the bar because you come home from the bar. You don't want to wear any wool sweaters to the bar because they smell like smoke for weeks. I don't think it means you're inhaling it when you're wearing the sweater because it smells bad.
Let me be clear. I'm not quarreling that it's a matter of degree, as you and the prior caller said, but that suggests that you're not inhaling it at all, and I choose to inhale none of it if I possibly can. It's ridiculous.
Here's another email on my side.
Well, go ahead. Let's hear it.
Christopher says, let's talk about education, not banning Big Brotherism at its worst.
Let's take one more quick one. Taylor, you're in Burlington. You're on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie, wrap it up, Taylor.
Hi. Oh, God, I love you guys so
Thanks.
Much.
Thanks.
I just think I want to say that it's especially hard for people who are trying to quit smoking to have to be around the smell of cigarette smoke, and that I think they should take it a step further and ban it from workplaces. Because I have a brother who would really like to be able to quit smoking, but every time he goes to work, he's forced to be surrounded by the smell and people who smoke. And I know for sure that he'd be able to quit if he didn't have to be exposed to that kind of thing.
But do we not have, Marjorie, a statewide ban in workplaces in Massachusetts, or am I wrong?
I think everybody's outside huddled in the cold.
No, I think there is
pedophiles.
Well, whatever.
In February.
Well, brother,
what's that, Taylor?
My brother works at Salvation Army in Woburn, and right in the back where they all pile all the furniture and everything, everyone is constantly smoking, and there's just no way you can really get away from it. So.
Hey, Taylor, I am more with you than you could possibly know. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay. I guess I was pummeled on that one.
No,
Jim.
You weren't pummeled. There were some people who were misguided with you. So it's fine. It was perfect.
When we come back, it's time for Callie Crossley, host for Under the Radar. She's going to join us. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston icon Mel King got an early taste for community organizing.
The folks in the neighborhood decided that I should run for the position.
The position was a member of a newspaper tribunal when King was 14. And the outcome?
We won. It was my first education in community organizing.
I'm Adam Riley. Join us for a conversation with Mel King Sunday night at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Subaru of New England, introducing the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com. And the MIT Museum, presenting Living in the Future on Saturday, September 28th. You can enjoy movie night with pizza and popcorn and inventors who will answer your questions about futuristic technologies, beginning at 6 p.m.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Before we introduce who's with us, you know, I'm just thinking at the top of the show, we announced what we were doing this hour, and I believe I failed to mention, I just realized, that John Connolly, who is one of the two finalists for mayor of Boston, is joining us in about 10 minutes. My apologies to the listeners and apologies to Councillor Connolly. I don't know how I did that. In any case, he's joining us soon. But first, joining us, as she does every single Friday, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which airs on WGBH Sunday nights at 6:30. Hello, Callie Crossley.
Hello, Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan.
Hello, Callie Crossley. Now, Jim Browdy is in a frenzy over this, so I'm going to let him.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I'm
so glad you threw it back to me. Here is United States Senator Ted Cruz during his 21-hour and certain number of minutes, quote, filibuster of the spending bill in the Senate.
You go to the 1940s, Nazi Germany. Look, we saw in Britain Neville Chamberlain, who told the British people, accept the Nazis. Yes, they'll dominate the continent of Europe, but that's not our problem. Let's appease them. Why? Because it can't be done. We can't possibly stand against them.
So equating critics of his stand on Obamacare, it's almost hard to even say the words, to Nazi appeasers, but he was not alone this week. I would argue Callie Crossley, equally crass, if not more so, the CEO of AIG, I didn't know his name before, Robert Ben Mosh, I think is how you pronounce it. He was suggesting that criticism of bankers' bonuses, this is a quote, was intended to stir public anger, to get everybody out there with their pitchforks and their hangman nooses and all that, sort of like we did in the Deep South, comparing the criticism of bankers' bonuses after the bailouts to lynchings in the Deep South. Who is more crass, Mr. Ben Mosh or Senator Cruz?
I can't make a judgment on it. They're both, you know, they've transcended crass to something beyond crazy. And you know what this is all about? People know there are things that happened in history that were really bad, and they've evaluated or devalued the depth of the pain. So it's like, you know, I'll just throw that out there because I know it's really bad, and you'll understand what I mean when I say this is really bad, and so was this. Are you kidding? I mean, it's just...
And by the way, we should say
you're
defense...
absolutely right. It's totally like... Exactly. The devaluing of it is exactly what's going on.
And by the way, the AIG guy subsequently apologized. I mean, he said it, but he apologized. Cruz has not apologized. You know, there's certain lines in debate in a civil society, which we theoretically argue don't cross. I would suggest doing comparisons to anybody who was lynched in the South or Nazis,
the Holocaust
is probably something you shouldn't compare virtually anything to, particularly criticism of your bonuses or your position on the Affordable Care Act.
I just find that just...
But you hear it. You hear it a lot.
I know. Well, John McCain took to the floor after Ted Cruz and said, really?
Good for him.
No, this is outrageous.
Yeah.
Stop it. Stop using this comparison.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of people died there. What are you talking about?
You know, it turns out he's not... I wasn't aware of this, but the guy who... When I lived in New York, he used to shop at Christie's. Well, the CEO of Christie's, his name is John... It's a grocery store. Katsimatidis, I believe, is his name. When there were talks about raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans, he said it's sort of similar. He says that to how Nazi Germany treated the weak. He was analogizing to how the advocates for taxing the top 1 or 2% were being treated, were treating those people. I almost can't get the words out. It is so surreal that a person in a position of power who is educated could ever say those words.
I'm going to say two things. Other than the devaluation, which I believe is going on here, I don't know that some of these, quote, educated people actually understand the depth of it. They sort of know it was bad and was in the history books and I got it in high school. Yeah. But then, you know, the depth of it, because then you'd stop yourself if you understood exactly what was happening. You would.
Yeah.
And so I just don't know that these quote unquote educated people are educated. My mother said education was more than books. You know, that
good
you had
point
to know
from
something
your mother.
About
good point.
People. I don't know. I just think it's what for me is extra appalling is that these people have public platforms by which to put this stuff out. And I unfortunately think that every time one of these quotes goes around, somebody reads it and in their head they think, I know it's not a good thing, but he made the analogy because he's trying to make a point about it being a bad thing. And I don't think that the depth of the pain and the lack of morality, the outrageousness of what was going on gets across.
The best part of this is what you mentioned a minute ago. Far more important than these gentlemen being trashed by Kelly Crossley, Marjorie Egan, and me is that John McCain stood up and took on a fellow member of his own party, considering John McCain's not crazy about Obamacare either.
Right.
So we're going to go from the sublime to what I would consider to be the ridiculous, because I am told you are worked into a frenzy about this particular ad for Prince Spaghetti. Listen up.
Traditions are alive and well in the north end of Boston, like coming home for Prince Spaghetti Day. For over 100 years, Prince and families like Anthony's have been making great pasta.
So we know that this is a remake of an old Anthony, Anthony. Everybody loved the commercial.
Everybody.
Why don't we love the new commercial? What's wrong with the new commercial?
Well, I was shocked to find out that they didn't use the new. When I saw the new commercial, I got all excited, ran to my TV, because I thought the guy who comes through the door as a grown person was the Anthony.
Who was in the original commercial.
Original, yes. Like the grown-up version. Then I read, it's an actor, and I'm thinking, well, I wonder why they did an actor. Well, then I read they could have had the real guy and they didn't. Then they wouldn't even use the real guy's son. And I'm like, what? You know, this just bespeaks of tone deafness from a company. Because I saw this ad before I ever lived in Boston. And I thought, wow.
Me too,
this
by the way.
Must be what Boston is
How
about.
Neat the North End looked.
Right, look at that spaghetti.
What
looks
fun
good.
Place to live.
You know, all of that kind of stuff. It had a community sense to it, which is the point of it, which is what the marketing people wanted to get across. So it worked for me. I didn't even live here. It worked for the people. They used the real people. You had the opportunity to use the real people now. You know what it is? It's not a local company anymore.
Where is it?
To be
you
a local,
know where
some
is?
Big, you know.
You know what I love about this?
I would have preferred just a rerun of the old ad, frankly, to this new
That's
fangled thing.
That's a brilliant idea, actually.
Because it would have been a picture of the North End as it used to be, whenever that ad was 20, 30 years ago, and the same kid. It would have been very nostalgic. It would have made me actually be interested in Prince Spaghetti, which otherwise I'm really.
And they're celebrating their 100th anniversary, so that was the reason they did it. But to your point, they could have run the old ad and say, we're still the original, and, you know, played that. Or they could have updated it, which I think people love to see. They would love to see that kid and say, he still says, I'm eating my spaghetti.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that would be, and it doesn't matter if you lived in Boston. It gives you something special. I got to say.
And the guy's a court officer. And
yeah,
he's got a 9-year-old
kid. The kid looks so cute.
It's adorable. He's adorable.
So my question is, what's going on with pasta companies in general? Because you heard about this thing with Barilla. Because I figured, I'm not eating Prince anymore because that's my personal boycott. You know,
Barilla is a little higher end.
Okay. Well, now the guy in Italy, there's a boycott against him because he says we would never use non-traditional families in our ads. And by that, they meant gay families. So there's a whole boycott about it. And the head guy, fourth generation family, it's still privately owned. He said, you don't like it? Don't eat the pasta.
Well, you know what's amazing? I just heard about that. And while he was making that statement, he was eating something from Chick-fil-A. Did you know that? You know, by the way, Callie, the definition of a Renaissance woman is a woman who in the same conversation can be appalled by references to Nazism.
Yes.
And and a Prince
she's versatile.
Spaghetti.
She's versatile.
Yes.
She
now,
can get
Kelly,
worked up in a wide range.
I know. I got to get a new spaghetti now.
Now, most of us know that when you're having pasta
or
spaghetti,
right,
if you're going Prince, the thing you want next to it, of course, is something that is actually one of your areas of expertise, which not everybody knows it is. It is full, sadly. I guess you know this.
Yes, I know.
It is full.
I'm very sad about that.
So if
Me
we're
too.
Not doing Prince spaghetti, because we're appalled that Anthony Martignetti is not in the spot, we're doing some other pasta, and we're sitting down. Do you have a full wine or two or three that
well,
you want to
all,
send in our direction?
You know, the easiest thing to do is to go with the country of origin. So if you're talking spaghetti, that's Italian, so you want to look there. And so Chianti Classico is really quite good. Now, I'm not talking about the stuff that used to be on the bottle with the straw wrap around it.
Yeah.
I'm talking about some good stuff that's a whole other world.
What is Classico? I mean, I bought. You know, what does Classico mean in that case? Is
well,
it a higher?
Yes.
It's
yes,
a higher
yes,
quality.
Yes, and it's delicious, and it doesn't have to be expensive. You know, you can. It can be very expensive, but what I'm talking about are wines that have to be expensive. If you don't want to go that way, then one of my personal favorites is Rioja. Again, an inexpensive red from Spain.
How do you spell that?
Rioja.
Okay.
She's writing it down.
It's very popular.
It's a good sign.
It's
how much
very
is
popular.
Not expensive in your world?
12-ish.
Oh, that's not horrible.
No, no, no.
No, that's
and you
not
can,
bad at
and
all.
You can get it on sale. I mean, you look around, you can get the stuff on sale. Another Italian red that I personally like is Nero Diavolo, which I drink during the winter as well. And I don't like traditional sort of – I like some traditional reds, but I tend to try to go off the track so not to be so common. Now, a lot of people listening are going to say, I don't drink red. I'm sorry. I just don't care about it. So they want to do something else. So, you know, why support local folk. For people who like Chardonnay, I don't like Chardonnay. I don't drink it. But this is very good Chardonnay, Turtle Creek, Massachusetts Company. And it's delicious, won all kinds of awards. And, you know, Chardonnay is a full-bodied white, so you can really have it with hearty food, as well as Viognier. Viognier is a French white, but it's also made in California. And that's for that's just a hearty food wine. You can throw practically any food at it, and it's good.
I didn't know you knew this much about wine.
Of course
did you go to the wine school there with Jonathan?
No. But Jonathan's, you know, my buddy. But
he's great.
He's
yeah,
great.
He's
but where
fabulous.
Does where does this come from? I don't mean your knowledge.
No.
Where does the interest come from?
Well, I used to
deep,
just have no interest in it, and you know, drink what I used to drink. What my friends commonly refer to as rot gut. Now, there's nothing wrong with good rot gut, I say. But anyway, I didn't know the names of it. And then I just got interested in it and, you know, started really paying attention to some of the details of it. And the most important thing is to taste different things, because you get in a rut, you know, like you do with even foods you eat. You get in a rut. And once you taste different things and you think, wow, there's so much else out here that I could drink.
Now, Kelly Crossley, I am making a bet. We have on the line, we're going to talk to him about 90 seconds, one of the two men who will be the next mayor of Boston. That'd be John Conley. I'm guessing that you're under the radar on Sunday night, I hope I'm not wrong, is a mayoral reflection. Is that a preliminary reflection?
And normally, you know, we don't do a lot of stuff that's on the radar as well. But so in this case, we take a subject that's on the radar, which is, you know, the new winners of the preliminary election, and take an under-the-radar approach to it. Really do a deep dive into, you know, what it's going to mean for these guys as they try to go out of their neighborhoods or even perceptions about what they stand for into reaching out and getting the vote that's going to carry them over the top. So we have some fabulous people to talk about it who know these things deeply.
Oh, great.
And I'm excited to have,
you want to tell us who they are?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sue O'Connell, of course.
Love her.
And,
Bay Windows.
Kelly Bates, who's at Emerson.
Also terrific.
And our own Peter Katsas.
Not so bad.
Great cast.
And I hope I get a word in.
Hey, Kelly Crossley, we'll be listening Sunday night.
Oh, thank you
at
for the wine suggestions, too. I'm
and
psyched.
We hope you're listening to John Connolly in a couple of seconds for your Sunday night show. Kelly, great to see you every Sunday night at 6:30 Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. Very brief break, and then John Connolly joins us on Boston Public Radio. Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. There are two men who have a chance to be the next mayor of Boston after 20 years of Tom Menino. One was Marty Walsh. We talked to him, I think, on Wednesday. We are now speaking to City Councilor John Connolly. John, congratulations on making the final two.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
Hi, John. Thanks for calling in. You know, before we get to some of the questions about what you're going to do and so forth, there was a great moment where a lot of us who remember having young kids were very nervous for you, John, because you're up there on the stage. You know, you get the three kids, a little infant. You got two other kids.
You know, wait, he doesn't have the little infant. His wife has the little infant.
But you're the school czar, John. You'd be in big trouble if the kids were misbehaving. Now, what happened when you're giving your speech the other night?
Well, fortunately, we didn't have any sort of Rudy Giuliani son moment. But I will say the entire time, I think it was off camera. I haven't seen, but my daughter was yanking at my suit coat behind the podium.
Wait, while you're talking?
While I was talking, just yanking at it, and that was a little nerve wracking for me. But it was a pretty cute moment.
And I heard about that, John Connolly, when I saw you last night on Jim Browdy's A Broadside Show. And I also, to change to a serious subject, wanted to ask you about something I heard last night as well. You were saying that you were going to stick to your issues in the campaign and not get into any criticism about your opponent, Marty Walsh, and his ties to labor. But as you know, the front page of the Herald and the Globe today are all about this arbitration award to the Boston Police, one of the unions there, that could cost the city up to $125,000 in back pay. So who's going to take care of this if this gets to you guys when one of you is the mayor? Union affiliation is a big issue. So why is it off the table?
Well, I think what I was saying last was that I do not want to engage in negative campaigning or campaigning where we're talking about each other's character. I think discussions of the issues is obviously very fair. And I think we discuss the issues, we talk about our message, our priorities, and then let the voters make up their mind.
Because one of the things, you know, Marty Walsh says is that because he is more trusted than unions, he says he's more trusted by unions than you are, that things won't get to arbitration as the firefighters contract did in the city and the police contracts have in the city, that he'll be the better negotiator than you. What do you say to that?
Well, listen, I want to reserve judgment on the police contract right now because the arbitrator has issued the award and I haven't read anything, and it's not available yet other than what's in the newspaper. So I want to make sure I have all the facts before I comment on that. But look, when you go to negotiate, it's about leverage. It's not about hugs and rainbows and lollipops. And we saw it clearly in the teacher's contract. We got one of the shortest school days for our kids out there. That means they don't get art and music the way they ought to. And we have some of the most archaic hiring rules. Because we didn't use all the tools at our disposal at the negotiating table. I think it's about negotiating in a fair manner, but it's the leverage that drives it. And if we want to change the teacher's contract or get changes in any of these contracts, you have to go to the table in a very serious manner. I don't think it's about being able to just pat somebody on the back and expect them to then agree to something.
You know, one last thing about this, John Connolly, I wasn't sure. Where did you vote in favor of the firefighters contract in 2010? That was the one that got a lot of criticism, and Michael Ross, then the council president, voted against it, saved the city $45 million. Where were you on that firefighter contract?
So we all ultimately voted for it, but I was part of a coalition of councilors that held the line and sort of, Mike Ross led it as the council president, but I was part of a coalition of councilors who said, functionally, we need to get a better deal here.
Okay.
We're speaking to John Connolly, obviously city councilor, who hopes he's going to be mayor or mayor-elect as of November 5th. Speaking of news in the paper this morning, John Connolly, there are side-by-side stories. Well, they're in both papers. Side-by-side stories, though, I'm looking at the business section of the Globe. On the right side is a story both about the Boston Redevelopment Authority voting 4-1 to authorize a $7.3 million deal with the Red Sox to allow them use forever of public streets around Fenway, even though there was an objection by the Boston Finance Commission, by the Inspector General. And on the left side of the page is the same BRA voting to give a $7.8 million tax break, one the mayor used to oppose, for the developers of Downtown Crossing and Filene's. What's your take on both of these decisions by the BRA, John?
I just think that we just have to start with the notion that we need a more transparent BRA that is going to actually have real process where the community can get input, where everybody's aware of what's going on before we make a decision, and that it's not done in the way it's done right now, where it really feels like preordained conclusions. You have sort of a fake community process and then a vote by the board, and it doesn't and it results in deals where, you know, we're not necessarily getting the best value for the taxpayers in Boston.
So let's just stay for one second with one I think people are more familiar with, the Red Sox thing, the Yawkey Way thing. Let's assume you look at this and decide that not only was there not transparency, but frankly, it was a rotten deal for the taxpayers of Boston. You take over in January. Do you have any interest in, and would you have power in any way to undo or renegotiate this deal?
Unfortunately, once that deal is done and agreed to, there's not a whole heck of a lot you can do under, as I understand the terms of that. I haven't read the contract myself, but as I understand the terms, but look, I think anything, you know, where you're able as mayor to revisit or relook at anything that's not working the right way ought to be looked at.
So on that last note on this, John Connolly, if I may, I know a topic that came up in the NECN Herald Suffolk debate. A number of you, maybe all of you, I don't remember, were asked the question about should the mayor slow down on all things large or close to large, and I guess you could argue both of these are. Are you of the school who believes that major decisions like this, where there does not need to be an urgent vote, should be held until you or Walsh take over the city?
No, I think, listen, I want the BRA to work properly, and I'd like it to work properly now. It will certainly work properly if I'm mayor, but overall, you know, the mayor has to be mayor here right up until his last day. And I think on the whole, he's trying to make decisions that are right for Boston. Am I concerned that the BRA is maybe loading up the pipeline and trying to get as many things through as possible? Yeah, and I don't think that that's appropriate. But overall here, what I want to be clear on, though, is we've got to let Mayor Menino be the mayor while he's going. The best case to look at the housing plan. He put out a great housing plan. And it's really a blueprint for the next mayor. I think you take it, some of the things you run with, some of the things may change. But I'm glad he's following through on items like that, that he's been talking about and working on for years here. We don't, you know, he's the mayor right up until the next mayor takes over. We don't want him to stop doing the job.
Have you spoken to him since Tuesday night, by the way?
I talked to him Tuesday night. I did talk to him briefly after that.
Did he smile at you? What did he say to you?
I can't tell if you're. I can't tell about smiles on the phone.
Oh, okay. Fair enough, John.
So, John Connolly, you're running against Marty Walsh. Both you, you're a city councilor, you're an attorney. You've been a crusader for the schools. Marty Walsh, state representative, has a distinguished career. I think lots of people aren't clear how you guys are different. So tell our listeners, what would be a couple of things you would say that would distinguish you from Marty Walsh in terms of your vision for the city?
Well, look, I start with my time in the classroom. And I did, you know, 3 years, every day I went in the classroom. My students were overwhelmingly the victims of the achievement gap. And that changed my life, that experience of seeing the challenges that our young people face who are growing up in poverty and who are victims of the achievement gap. That informs my perspective on everything. And I don't think there is any candidate in the race, all 12 of us, who will take on the Boston Public Schools the way they need to be taken on and fight the tough battle to make sure every child can get a high quality education. I think that's the big differentiator. And, you know, I've got 6 years here working in every corner of Boston across every community. And I think I have a great understanding and feel for the city and an ability to build coalitions and an ability to help get things done by reaching every community in Boston. I think it was shown when I partnered with Ayanna Pressley for re-election, something that had never been done in Boston before. And I think it was shown on the student assignment issue, one of the most divisive issues in Boston's history. I built a citywide coalition. I had Linda Dorsina-Forey, Russell Holmes from Mattapan and Dorchester, and Nick Collins from South Boston, part of the same coalition to support a reform plan on that.
Hey, John, I just realized I left the other thing. Who called who? Did you call Menino or did he call you?
No, I called him.
I love your laugh. There's
that's
something
the way,
more
that's
in that.
The way it works. Okay. That's the way it works for all city councilors.
Okay. Hey, John, speaking of what you just mentioned, you mentioned Linda Dorsina-Forey, who is neutral in the race, Ayanna Pressley, others. Have you asked any of your fellow, well, obviously 10 of the 12 people for endorsements yet, or Dorsina-Forey or Pressley? Have you reached out and asked for endorsements or no?
I haven't really explicitly asked for endorsements. I mean, I talk to people all the time, but my number one focus, honest to goodness, is getting out there and talking to as many voters as possible about my vision. I think that's how you win campaigns. You know, I started in this campaign when it looked like I was going to be running against Mayor Menino, and I certainly wasn't asking for endorsements then because I wouldn't have gotten any. And I just sort of built my campaign that way going forward. Go out and talk to as many people as you can. And that's sort of how I am still doing it.
So, John, how long was the call with Tom? No, I'm only kidding. So, John Connolly, last thing from...
It lasted about a minute.
So, John, one other thing that's been a big deal today is this whole People's Pledge thing, the special interest money in the race. And you've called on Marty Walsh to sign the pledge, and he has rejected your call. Why is this so important to you?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that it doesn't look like we're going to have one. I'm going to make one more effort here. But, I think it's important because the outside money warps the debate. You know, we could have millions pour in here on all sides, and it will warp the debate. It will become a debate that's just about TV ads, and ultimately it will get to, you know, comparative ads that are inaccurate, negative ads, whatever it may be. And we want to talk to the people directly about schools, about jobs, about safety. That's the kind of campaign we ought to have where the candidates are talking to the people directly and the campaigns are doing the work. Not where outside groups are warping the debate. And that's why I think the People's Pledge could really set the right tone and help us continue the great preliminary that we had in the final.
Hey, John, though, yesterday when Marty Walsh responded to your statement, he said you had called it a political gimmick during the campaign, which you had. He also said, I don't trust him, meaning you, on this issue. Quickly, if you can, how do you respond to both of those statements by Representative Walsh?
Well, I was disappointed he attacked my character. I think the other piece has just been really misrepresented. I said the gimmick piece at the very same press conference where I said I didn't want outside money. I said the pledge was a gimmick because I agreed with Marty. If all 12 candidates didn't sign it, it couldn't work. But I also agreed with Marty when he said if every candidate would sign it, I would sign it and it would work. And that's where I stand today. We can both sign this in about 30 seconds and change, make sure this race is a great race to the end.
Hey, last question from me. I think in fairness, I asked Marty Walsh the other day because I know he'd spoken a lot about his late father, both to us before the election and then on election night, how he feels his father would have reacted. I never knew his father. I knew yours, former Secretary of State, and he helped introduce me to Massachusetts politics here and there. How did your father react to, well, obviously your mother, I don't mean to bypass your mother, but particularly since I knew your father, and everybody knew your father, how did your father react to Tuesday night? What did he say to you Tuesday night?
You know what, just a big hug and just, I think, a conversation I'd keep between the two of us, but other than to say he was real proud, but the thing I would note in it in our conversation, he never wanted me to run for office.
Is that so?
Yeah, he was dead set against it from the get-go.
Why?
I just think he felt like it's a tough business, and he didn't ever want to be in a position of watching his kids get beat up in the media.
Yeah.
And so he was always against it. It's really, honestly, my dad was the guy who helped me do my math homework and coach my football team. My mom was the person who really instilled in me a passion for public service.
Hey, but John, now everybody wants to know, in light of what I asked you about Menino, who called who? Did you call your father? Did he call you? How long was the... Hey, John Connolly, we really appreciate your time. City Councilor John Connolly, running for mayor. Hope to talk to you a lot during the campaign, John.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
Thank you for joining us, John Connolly. And when we come back, we're going to ask you a question. It tests your morality, your instincts, your reflexes, not to mention your physical strength. That question up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
get ready for the next live broadcast from Scholars Jazz Club. It's vibes player Gary Burton and the new Gary Burton Quartet on his 70th birthday tour. I'm jazz host Eric Jackson, and I hope you'll listen in tonight at 10, live from Scholars here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Stana Stairlifts, whose stairway chair lifts can make it easier and safer to get up and down stairs. You can learn more at stairliftboston.com or by calling 1-800-UPSTAIR. And great performances with an acclaimed miniseries that examines four of Shakespeare's most famous history plays. This week, Henry IV, starring Jeremy Irons. Watch The Hollow Crown, Friday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. You know the famous thought experiment that's been kicked around the philosophy departments and universities for decades? You know this. It goes like this. There's a runaway trolley barreling down the railroad tracks. Ahead on the tracks, there are five people tied up and unable to move. Trolley is headed straight for them. You're standing off in the distance next to a lever. If you pull the lever, the trolley will switch to a different set of tracks. But unfortunately, you notice there is one person on the side track. So you have two options, Marjorie. One, do nothing, and the trolley kills the five people in the main track. Two, pull the lever, diverting the trolley onto the sidetrack, where it'll kill one person, which is the correct choice. So that's what goes on in ivory towers. But down on the ground, or at least underground, real subway riders have been faced with a similar predicament. You've all read about this. Most recently, this happened on the Orange Line. A guy who just passed his med boards, I think it was, falls on the tracks.
His parents must be proud.
Three bystanders actually jump onto the tracks to rescue him. It's not the first time this has happened, but there have been times when no one went to the rescue. We want to know, is this something you would do? Do you have that instinct as a part of you? Are you a fight or flight kind of person? We want to know what you would do in this situation at 877-301-8970. And before you even answer, good for those three courageous souls.
And when you see the video, which is on YouTube and you can see it elsewhere as well, you see the guy, the medical student who had a couple too many, I guess, just walk. Like right off the edge of the – right over the yellow line there, right into the – onto the tracks and in a, almost a field position there. You see the guy trying to clap to get his attention. He's paying
before
no
they
attention.
Jump onto the tracks, right?
Yeah. Then you see this other guy, looked like he was about 20, young black kid that comes down – comes from the other side of the tracks.
So what does he have to cross?
He crosses over the electrified tracks. He comes from the other side.
I know. It's
unbelievable. So two guys from one side – this young kid from the other side walks over the tracks. They lift him up. They put him back on the side. Then the young black kid just hops back across the tracks again.
Like nothing.
And goes back and stands there with his hands in his pocket like, oh, happens every day. No big deal.
So we want to know, we're going to tell you in a minute if we think we'd have the you-know-whats to do. We want to know if you would at 877-301-8970. Would you jump down onto the tracks? You have no idea how soon the train is coming to help rescue someone. By the way, here's some bystanders talking about this Wednesday night rescue on the Orange Line.
They took a really big risk. I commend them for that. They took a huge risk, especially one that came from the other side.
The third rail, he could have easily died. It's impressive. He risked his own life to save someone else's.
You know, it literally, I almost can't breathe when I think of these guys.
Okay.
What?
Would you do it?
Well, I told you what I told you when we discussed in a similar situation years ago. I like to think that I would, but I fear that I would not. And I really feel horrible. I really, even though you make fun of me occasionally, I like to think I actually care about other people, particularly other people in harm's way.
I think you care.
I just don't know if I'd have the courage to jump on the tracks when
a
train might begin. But I also like to believe that it's unimaginable that I'd let someone die when I would arguably have the ability to save them.
You have to have certain conditions here. First of all, it's good to be a woman in these situations because you always expect the manly men to jump in and do the right thing first.
Yeah, right.
As happened in this case, there were women standing there. They didn't do anything. The guys went and did it. But I think it's also if you are alone and you're the only person standing between life and death, then even I, and I'm a big chicken, and I couldn't pick the guy up either, but even I think would go in and try to like drag him or something or wake him up or something. But if there's a group of people, you know, they talk about this in psychology classes in school too.
You're
if there's
totally
20
right.
people, everybody always expects the other person is going to do it. And then nobody ends up doing it. So in this case, there were a lot of people, and three people sprung quickly into action. And the guy from the other side, to me, was totally amazing. He could have watched the other two people, but he ran and came down to rescue the guy. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Now, here's what I would never do. Remember the story from...
It's the greatest story
this is the guy,
of heroism.
This guy named Wesley Autry, who was a Vietnam veteran. He's standing in New York City on the subway, 137th Street, and he sees a guy fall on the platform. He is right where the train is going to come over.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike in this case where there were no trains coming, this Boston case, there was a train coming. And he's standing there with his two little girls who are like about 6 and 7 or something like that. He jumps down into the platform, realizes he doesn't have time to move the guy out.
This is the most incredible part.
The guy's having seizures and stuff like this. He lies over the body, and the train comes over them both.
By how many inches does it miss them? Do you know?
Like about half an inch?
3 inches.
3 inches.
He puts his body over another person he doesn't know with the notion that the likely outcome, I assume, is that you're going to be dead and probably protecting the person under you.
I'm not doing that.
877-301-8970. What kind of person does that? Are you that kind of person? And while we're waiting to take your call, which we'll do in a minute, here's Wesley Autry himself, the hero of the New York subway story that Marjorie told. He's talking to David Letterman about this unbelievable rescue. Listen to him.
So you get down on top of the guy in the trough, and the train comes, and the guy, the conductor, the engineer who's operating the train, is braking. He sees that they're troubled, but he can't stop it in time.
He can't stop. He's tooting his horn, and you can hear the brakes squeaking.
Right.
But by the time he came to a full stop, five cars went shoo, shoo. And then I got this guy, he's steady, you know, trying to, and I got him locked down, and I'm like, yo, excuse me, sir, I don't know you, you don't know me.
Excuse me, sir.
That's the best part. Excuse me, sir. 877-301-8970. Would you do it? And it really does take, I mean, notice he's a Vietnam vet, by the way.
Vietnam vet, although he said it had nothing to do with being a hero.
That.
It was just sort of an instinctual thing. Now, the other thing about Wesley Autry, like I said, he had his two daughters, that you know, little girls that he had by the hand. That's another thing. You can always use an excuse. Well, I would have done it, but, you know, I had my children there with me, and I couldn't, you know, risk leaving my children alone. Unfortunately, my children are grown up now, so I wouldn't have that as an excuse anymore. But you could always use the, I'm the mother excuse, you know what I'm saying?
And by the way, while you said the train was not coming in the Orange Line circumstance, they didn't know. They didn't see it, unlike Wesley Autry in New York. It could have been 30 seconds away, as far as they know.
The headlights barreling down on them, as this guy Wesley Autry did, who to me should have won some sort of heroism medal or something like that. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Forget Wesley Autry. That's too tough a one. We'll talk about Boston right here.
That's a little bit easier, I agree.
Have jumped onto the track to rescue this apparently drunken medical student.
Who remembers none of this, by the way.
Who remembers none of it. Who was out celebrating. Once again, his parents, I'm sure, were very, very proud of him on that particular night. Joe from New Hampshire. What do you think, Joe?
How you doing?
Great.
No, not at all.
There's one honest man. Now, why is that, Joe?
I'm going to tell you. All right, let's look at it this way, okay? I jump on those tracks. If this guy's drinking, I got one life, all right? If he's going to push me on the electric part of that, I'm dead, right? Another thing is, I don't know, and this is just being honest, I don't know when that train's coming around that corner. I would rather not take the chance of ending my own life because someone was drinking and stupid enough to walk off the side of
it. Yeah, but Joe, the one faulty part of your premise is, I'm assuming that the three people who came to the rescue didn't know that this was a drunken guy who chose to get drunk, and then all they knew was there was a guy on the tracks who was unresponsive to their clapping and yelling, so they weren't able to do that kind of analysis. So if you didn't know that irresponsible personal behavior got them there, you still wouldn't do it, right?
Absolutely.
Good. Joe, you're one honest soul. I wasn't sure we'd get one. Thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. Can I tell you, the more I think about this, I think that in the Wesley Autry situation where the train, you can see the train coming. I feel bad saying this. I can't imagine having the courage to do it. I would like to think, the more I think about this, that if I didn't see the train coming, even though I know it could be around the bend, that I would jump down.
I
would not jump across.
With the Wesley Autry situation, you're thinking you're going to orphan your children. And that would be my excuse. You know, this is terrible, but what about my children? I would think of my children first.
I would not jump across the third rail, which was electric. That if I was on the right side, I would do it.
Well, that's right. And the guy that came over from the other side, he was very agile. I mean, he ran down the tracks. Yeah. He jumped over. He was in good condition, unlike some of the rest of us. Bill from Marblehead. I wasn't talking about you, Jim.
Go ahead.
Bill from Marblehead, would you jump into the subway tracks to rescue Good Samaritan like this poor medical student who had one too many?
Well, the answer to that question is yes, I would, because I know there's enough clearance under the trains to maneuver if you need it. But I was calling to answer the philosophical question.
Oh, about the thing, the lever, do you switch to away from killing five to kill one as opposed to the alternative? Yeah, what's the answer?
Well, in my opinion, it's always the third alternative.
What's that?
You need to seek the third alternative. And this is what we're not doing in life right now in our politics.
What's that?
But the third alternative here is to wedge the switch so the trolley picks it and stops.
Oh, well, you'd have to be pretty clear. I would have no idea how to do that, Bill. Would
Nor
you?
Nor would I. Well, but this is a guy who knew that there was enough clearance under a...
Yeah.
So what do you do for a living that you know all these things, Bill?
I'm a minister.
Oh, well, most ministers know everything about how subways work.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask. So what is the morally right, reverend thing to do, Reverend Bill?
To go to the aid of your fellow human being.
Okay, even if it means leaving...
And trust. The fellow that was talking about the one he did in New York,
yeah.
He jumped in and held the guy under the train. He didn't know there was enough clearance. He trusted that there was enough clearance.
That is exactly right, by the way. He did not know that there was 20-some inches and that he was, I believe, 3 inches shy of that. Bill, thank you for a fine spiritual moment here on the show. 877-301-8970.
Michelle just sent a neat email saying that many studies show that ants show heroism to defend the colony. So what do we make of that, Jim?
Well, it's the opposite of your collective notion. I mean, the most famous case of all of group non-response to something? Kitty Genovese. Was that in Queens 50 years ago?
Yes.
Was she being killed by somebody?
She was being stabbed to death. It was horrible.
And dozens of people heard it or saw it and did nothing. But that, if I believe...
Because they all thought everybody else was
going to
do something.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. And so they didn't do anything. Tom just emailed. He said he would send a special signal to Batman.
Yeah, what you said before. It is the hope that either Batman or somebody else is going to do something. But sometimes you have to do it yourself.
You always say, what is the point of having a man around if they're not going to take the garbage out? They're going to jump in to rescue the people in the
You're
subway.
You're not getting any email about how sexist
I'm being very sexist.
Nobody's responding to that?
Not yet, but I'm sure that will happen
soon. Let's take a couple more
soon.
Quick ones. Jim, you're in Lincoln. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Would you do it or would you not, Jim?
Well, let me tell you this. I did it, but I probably wouldn't have if I knew what I was doing. About 30, 40 years ago, I'm an older man.
Yeah.
I was walking through Filene's, and at that time, the first floor, they had a cosmetics department on the far end of the first floor. And as I approached it, I was cutting through because it was raining out, I noticed a big crowd. And then I looked, and I saw a lady standing next to a counter, leaning over it, sort of. And I walked over to her, and I said, "Are you all right?" And she pointed to a man about 20 feet away holding a long knife. He had been disreleased from some sort of institution earlier that day. And she said, "He stabbed me." And the guy was standing there with a big smile. He was deranged. And then I looked on the floor, and there was a pool of blood. Well, I just hollered to the clerk, get a chair, get a doctor. And it all turned out, you know, the cops came and got him. And all. My point is, though, would I have done that if I knew saw the knife and the blood beforehand? I don't know.
So was it your instinct is what moved you?
Instinct. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I did get $100 gift certificate from Filene's from my...
Oh, great. What'd you do with it, Jim? Buy a couple of suits? What'd you do? Hey, Jim.
Oh, I don't remember now.
I know. Jim, thank you for
sharing
a little piece of this. Let's take one more on this. I hope it's Yassim in East Boston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. How are you, Yassim?
Hi, sir. How are you?
Great.
Good.
What would you do?
If I remember, 2 years ago exactly, I was about to take the orange line, and all of a sudden I heard a drunk woman fell in the track. Boom. So automatically what I did, me and like other two people that I don't know, so we jumped to rescue her.
Now, were you able to rescue her?
I mean, yeah. We did, yeah.
And why are you laughing? Out of anxiety thinking about it? Why are you laughing?
He's nervous.
I mean, actually, yeah, because it's funny, because we didn't know how to rescue a person in that situation, because we never experienced something like that.
So why did you do it? Did you do it instinct, or was it a conscious decision to help a fellow human being?
I mean, instinctively. Mm-hmm. We didn't even think about what we're doing, so we just, you know, jumped right away to help her, because we know that she's drunk and she's not going to be able to handle herself, so... Mm.
Did you get a $100 gift certificate to Filene's or what? Where'd you get any reward or any recognition or anything, Yassim?
No, we didn't. The only reward that we got that we helped her.
That's a wonderful thing. The reward was that you helped her. Hey, Yassim, that's a great story, and thank you for sharing it. Look at that. He didn't even think. He just did it.
Elizabeth just emailed. She said, for all 38 years of our marriage, my husband has lived in fear. I am that sort of person, though, and it's just instinct. So there you go. Not sure what the state of the marriage is.
I don't know either, but there we go. I hope, you know, if we had been identified,
it's weird.
That is also
strange.
It's
weird because you can't see them very well on the picture. And I looked in this morning's paper, and as of this morning, they had not been.
Which hospital do you think is going to be hiring the drunken med board pastor? Say, oh, that's exactly the kind of guy I want here.
They haven't identified him yet either, yeah. But he's 33. He said he had two drinks.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a little suspicious
about
that.
Two drinks in each hand, I think.
Yeah.
In any case.
When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. She's got her weekly list of gripes. We'd love to hear those. And she's going to tell us about some really weird things that are happening at Newsweek magazine. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Sometimes in radio, you just have to let the tape speak for itself. So, here you go.
I'll have a cheeseburger. Hold the cheese. Hold it in your hand until it melts, until it bears that shape of that voluptuous palm of yours. Then put it on my burger.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Comedy Simplified. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Zander, performing Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, September 30th and October 4th at Symphony Hall and October 3rd at Mechanics Hall, bostonphil.org. And Fuller Craft Museum, with a reception celebrating two exhibitions, Art of Mosaics and Reversible Reactions, Art Meets Science at the MIT Glass Lab, Sunday, September 29th at 2 p.m., fullercraft.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and we are joined, as we are every Friday at about 1 o'clock on Open Mic, with Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
So, Emily, I have to ask you a quick question.
Yeah, Marjorie.
We were just talking about this guy, the three guys that jumped on the subway to rescue the drunken medical student. Would you do it?
I think I would.
Oh, I figured you would.
I am. You know, there's people who will put themselves in harm's way and people who won't. I remember driving with a boyfriend once out the Mass Pike, and this car, something happened. He shoved it into gear or something, and it was like something out of The Bourne Identity. It went flying into the woods, like soared into the woods. I said, stop, stop, stop. He says, no, we're not stopping. I said, we got to go help that guy. I jump out of the car, go running into the woods. He says, but the thing may explode. And I said, that's the whole point. We got to get the guy out.
Good for you.
And?
I got him out.
You did?
Yeah.
And you weren't worried the thing
was going to
explode?
Of course I was. Yeah.
Let me tell you something.
My father was like that, too. I just think my instinct is always to jump in.
Didn't you know she'd say that?
Not only did I know that I'd say that, all three of us are known pretty well by our colleagues in the newsroom. If they lined the three of us up against the wall right now and said, amongst those three people, which one is the most likely to do it, the vote would be unanimous.
Wouldn't it be Emily?
Yeah. It would.
Then me. You.
And then
you.
Well, good. I'm glad. I didn't know where you guys stood there.
Hey, Emily. Yeah. I am casino obsessed. Yeah. And the city council voted, I think, unanimously with one negative vote to limit the decision on whether or not the bid goes in from Boston for casino at Suffolk Downs, that the vote, pardon me, be limited to the people of East Boston. I've been dying here. What's your take
That's
on this?
That's because they want to make sure it goes through. They want to make sure that, because East Boston's going to vote for the casino and they don't want to see it go to Everett. And my take is if let the entire city vote, people would turn it down. They don't want a casino.
So you think it's purely motivated by what was the most likely positive outcome?
Yes.
But the argument is pretty compelling, though. If there's going to be a casino
in
Boston, I'd rather have it in Boston than in Everett if you live in Boston.
Yeah, I would too. But the argument for letting the whole city vote versus one neighborhood, as I keep pointing out, how about the BU Bio Lab? You know, nobody got to vote on that, including the people in the South End.
That's a great point. Well,
that more than anything, somebody should have gotten a vote on.
But let me be clear. Let's assume you didn't think that was the motivation, that the motivation was pure, that they decided. No, I'm serious, that they thought it was just the greatest impact, which obviously is true, is going to be on the neighbors on East Boston and their businesses, a lesser but not a non-existent impact. If all things were equal, which you don't think they are, should it have been a citywide vote or an East Boston?
Citywide.
I agree. You don't agree with that, Marjorie?
I hate to sound indecisive. I can see both sides of this because on the one hand, I think that there's going to be a casino either in Boston or in Everett. And if I lived in Boston, I'd rather get the money, all those millions of dollars, to do whatever you want to do with. But on the other hand, you can see where it is East Boston that's going to have all the traffic.
It's going to affect the entire city, the tax base, the more cops, you name it. It's going to affect everybody.
How about the airport? I mean, everybody uses the airport, for example. Yeah. Think about the impact on those roads out there, despite the mitigation and the spending. So you're voting present, is that correct?
I'm voting present. I hate to say, I could see both sides
present
of this issue. I'm sorry.
Right. You know, is there just on this before we leave? I've interviewed, and I know you have too, Steve Crosby, who I think was a good choice, actually,
to head
the Gaming Commission. And I've asked him on more than one occasion, and I knew what the answer would be, isn't it obvious that if Tom Menino wants a casino in Boston, the Gaming Commission is going to give Tom Menino the casino in East Boston? Well, Tom Menino is about not to be the mayor of East Boston. So is it conceivable that, what is it, Everett and Milford? Milford, I think, is the third. It's an M town, one of the three. Is it conceivable that even if the vote is affirmative in East Boston, that the casino does not go to Boston?
I'd say now it is, yeah.
Because Menino doesn't have the cloudy one.
Yeah, and there's not that dust up with Wynn, who's the one who's got the
Everett thing?
The Everett one going. So I think it's conceivable.
I'm interested in the Wynn Casino because when you go online and look at the casinos, you see that everything seems to be floating in water in his casinos. I would like to experience that up close.
Are you a casino goer?
No, but I've been to them. I've been to Atlantic City. I've been to St. Martin. You know, I've been to a casino.
You ever been to the Connecticut casinos?
No.
We drove to Sunday 10 years ago when Marjorie and I were on the other radio station. Marjorie said, Jim, you're complaining about casinos nonstop. You've never been to one, which I hadn't. So let's on a Sunday drive down. My description
depressing.
Was...
Well, for 20 minutes, you wouldn't get out of the car.
I was a little nervous. Yeah, that happens to be true. So we finally go into the slot parlor, and we don't know which one of the two casinos it was. First of all, as you drive up, there's nothing. And all of a sudden, the silver tower rises out of nowhere. Virtually no businesses, small businesses around it. And the description I gave is the slot parlor, which was packed, looked like a Civil War hospital. Oh, I mean, again,
the tubes up the nose.
Yeah, and almost all older people. Some people on walkers. Everybody smoking. I think they banned smoking in the Massachusetts casinos.
Depressing.
But it was so depressing.
It was dark.
Now, when I mentioned that to a colleague of ours, actually, I think I can mention Chet Curtis, a good friend of all of ours, who thinks I complain about everything. He said, "That isn't all the casinos are about." He says, "I don't gamble much when I go." He says, "The meals are fabulous and affordable. The shows are fabulous. You don't have to go gamble." Now, of course, my response to that was, I'm not worried about those people.
The articles in Playboy are really good, too. Well, come on.
In any case, but the bottom line is, I'm not a pro-casino guy, but my guess is the odds for Boston, as you agree, went down dramatically with the leaving town of Tom Menino, not leaving town, leaving office as of January. So,
tattoos.
Yeah.
Tell us about this situation in the United States military.
Yeah, the military. I find this interesting that the Army, I guess, I don't know if it's military-wide, but they've banned tattoos, visual tattoos, essentially. So you can't have anything from the elbow down or anything that would show when you're in uniform, which I kind of think I'm not big on banning anything, as you know, but I think there's something about that. There's some dignity. It's kind of like the Yankees.
I can't believe this is the place where you choose to be pro-banning.
I know.
These people are putting their lives at risk. They say it can't be sexist, racist. Obviously, I agree with that. But short of that, if someone wants to express themselves on their body when they're willing to put their body at personal risk,
but, you know,
let them do whatever the hell they want.
But to me, this is totally a generational thing because lots of people that are older, like we are appalled by the idea of I would never have a tattoo in my life.
Yeah, now
I mean,
everybody
like
does.
You were like a biker girl or something like that. You'd be like a bad girl, as we used to say when I was a kid. Now you go like to the gym or you go to yoga class. I mean, I like to go to yoga class. Everybody in there is tattooed all over their back. And these are people with serious
complicated
jobs.
Complicated,
elaborate tattoos all over their back and shoulders and
This too shall pass. I guess the Army is just sort of taking the first step saying, guys, get a grip.
Yeah.
That's all it is. You know, and it's not saying you can't have a tattoo, by the way.
But you just can't show them. And by the way, they will grandparent in people with existing tattoos as long as they're not racist
and sexist.
Think about
that. I mean, you got short sleeves on in the summertime. Yeah. That's a big chunk of body.
Keep it on your bicep. Keep it on your back. It's fine.
But you know, the other problem with this, I know this is just one person, so I shouldn't even bring it up. This means that if Lindsay Lee decides she wants to go in the military, you don't know who Lindsay Lee is? You haven't been to her Twitter page?
No.
Lindsay Lee is
the
partner of soon-to-be United States Senator
Cory
Booker.
Oh,
the woman who is the stripper
vegan
strip joint
Jim
in Portland, Oregon.
Knew more about that story than you and
feeling.
I did, Emily.
Yeah.
But yes, we did see her. Hey, she had a tattoo of her gun.
Yeah, in all seriousness, speaking of tattoos for
on
a second.
Her thigh.
And her.
And buttocks.
And everybody has read about Cory Booker, who's the mayor of Newark, who's the front runner for the Senate seat for place Frank Lautenberg, who did die, and I had said I wasn't sure if he had died, and someone confirmed the other day that I was right, that he did. You know, a lot of people are saying, and by the way, speaking of Cory Booker, I hope people heard the other day Deval Patrick tell the story that when he's at the Martin Luther King celebration, someone runs up to him and says, Cory Booker!
Mr. Booker!
I
know.
It was really cute.
I know.
It was great. But in any case, a lot of people are trying to compare, and by the way, there's no sex thing. There was just words going back and forth between Cory Booker and this vegan stripper in California. And my sense is not only was there no sex thing, he's single. And he didn't do anything immoral.
There's no problem.
That is what you think.
Yeah,
who cares?
And by the sound of it, she was more soliciting him, and he was just kind of responding. I mean, he wasn't, I don't think, going out of bounds.
How do we get down to this from tattoos?
Well,
I don't know.
She is tattooed.
Oh, that's
you saw
right.
the
there
photo.
She's tattooed.
By the way, the one tweet she sent him that I thought was troubling, when she said, could you call me later Deval? And he said, I'm not Deval. In any case,
Jim, she didn't tweet Deval. You don't want to cause a ruckus.
Oh, that was a joke.
That was a joke. And by the way, describe her tattoo, please. The gun.
She has a million on one of her thighs. She has a tattoo of a handgun, of a pistol. She is tattooed from
really.
Head
what
to
other
toe.
Ones does she have?
I don't remember. I didn't see them. In any case. We were in a newsroom meeting this morning. You were talking about what you're doing tonight on Beat the Press.
And
you told a story
that
I thought I misheard. This is astounding. Tell the story.
Well, first of all, you know, Newsweek magazine, what was left of it, because it had been digital. It was owned by Barry Diller. He offloaded it finally to this company, IBT, International Business something or other. Anyway, I believe its owners are sort of conservative Christians. I think that's a nice way of putting it. And anyway, they've put out these guidelines. First of all, anytime you speak about the company, you have to speak about the company in positive terminology. You can't say anything negative or you can lose your job. But worse than that, there's this dress code. You know, no jeans, no open-toed sandals. The dress code is quite onerous. And then you have to have neatly combed hair, well-groomed hair, and no hair coloring.
Natural color, it says. No,
natural color only.
That eliminates all the women over 30, I'd say. Who starts streaking.
And half the men.
And everybody in the GBH newsroom.
Yes, except you.
You know, I have jeans on. I'm wearing jeans
right now.
Right. Now, one thing about
outrageous.
I worried when I read the story that some sort of company types in the world are going to say, well, they own it. That's the, you know, and the perfect analogy is, what was the big flap when John Henry bought the Globe? well, are they going to be able to criticize the Red Sox? Can Dan Shaughnessy write honestly like he did in the past? Everybody that I knew said, if there's any limitation, and apparently there won't be, says Henry and Brian McGrory, that's outrageous. That's what this is here. Basically, saying that you cannot say anything unkind about your employer is staggering.
The employees' union has already filed some kind of lawsuit, yeah. The Writers Guild. But I don't even know what Newsweek is anymore. Where does it appear?
Well, it's digital. It's digital. After the Daily Beast experiment, they became, I believe they're, in fact, I'm sure, they're a digital-only publication. It's much thinner, even though it's online. There seems to me to be less content.
I wonder if it's kind of a religious thing now, too, or what it is.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't think it's the case.
It's a class action suit there by all the women who, if you go prematurely gray at 40, you know, the ageism kind of thing.
Yeah, and what are they going to do, go around checking to see?
That's right.
I mean, how are they going to?
Yeah. They'll be just checking for your roots.
Did you have your streaks done today?
No, this is at a magazine where there are journalists and other staff. No denim jeans, no sneakers, no baseball caps. As you say, open-toed sandals are not permitted. Hair must be its natural color, well-groomed. Staffers who, this is, quote, show up to work without meeting these requirements, quote, will be asked to return home to change into suitable clothing. It sounds like a school dress code.
It's really unbelievable. And then what are you going to do? Go home. What are you going to do if you've got color in your hair? Go home and how do you take that out?
I guess you have to resign from your job.
Shave your head?
I don't think anybody's going to want to read this publication. I mean, if these are the kind of people that are putting it out, I mean, my God.
By the way, they did say that you can have tattoos all over your body. That's the one, except they're into that. They have
especially
a weird
they like guns on your thighs.
Yeah. Okay, enough of the news. Here it is, what you've been waiting for 7 days.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
By the way, the best part of that, every week I think of this.
It's great.
It's the emphasis on absolutely.
Absolutely.
I have absolutely no interest. That, of course, is the introduction to the weekly Emily's List, brought to us by none other than Emily Rooney. Take it away, Emily.
All right. Well, Marjorie, you characterized me as having a list of gripes. It could be true.
I'm sorry.
It could be true.
What noun do you want? Whatever it is, Emily.
Observations.
Observations.
But
okay.
I am going to start with a gripe. Can you believe that they killed that Athol bear? They killed another bear. First of all, they shoot it. This is the same thing that happened in Newton last May with the poor little bear cub.
I didn't even know they killed an adult bear.
They tranquilize it, and this is true, to use a phrase you say all the time, Jim. This is true. They tranquilize it. It's on the ground, and then they euthanize it. You know why?
Why?
Because they claim that if they let it get up and wander away, and then some hunter came along and shot it and ate it, that they could die from the drugs that were in there.
Oh, please. Oh, please.
First of all, does anybody eat bear? And secondly, what are you talking about? Why did you tranquilize it in the first place?
When did this happen? How recently? Last week or so?
Yesterday.
That is pretty horrible.
What's so weird?
They killed it.
I mean, there are all these people being chased up and down Beacon Street by these wild turkeys that are living in the trees now. And they're screeching in the middle of the night. Do you know why the coyotes don't get them? I didn't know this.
No.
Did you know that they sleep in the trees?
Yeah, well, I've seen them roosting in the trees.
Yeah, I did not know that.
They roost.
That's why the coyotes can't get them.
Did you know that when you were off last Friday, weren't you?
I remember.
I think you were. And Emily listed right for the mayor's race the 10 things she's doing mayor. She said she would poison the geese in Boston.
I did. I was here for that.
Oh, you were?
Yes.
So
you were here. She wanted to poison the geese.
Yeah. Okay. I agree with you. We're with you on the bear.
Now, I'm moving on here.
Go ahead.
Some stories that just really made me nauseated this week. Starting with the front page of today's Boston Globe about that couple who both died young. I mean,
photograph on page one.
No, but the nauseating fawning and, you know, they're together in heaven and what the heck are you talking about? And they printed that story before we even know what the guy died of. I mean, we couldn't even wait for the autopsy.
It's like, you're right.
Where did that come from? And why is that front page news? And the maudlin, saccharine, sickening. I thought I was missing something.
I didn't have that reaction. Now I feel like I was missing something. What was your reaction? Did you see the story?
Well, I thought it was going to be a story about this woman's death. And then they turn the tables on you and the guy drops dead at 34.
What did he die of?
Well, cancer.
We don't know. No. He had like some
kind
of
cancer. Oh, right. That's right.
Must have been some heart thing. But we don't know.
Or maybe something else.
Yeah, I think we should wait till the autopsy comes in.
I just found the whole tone of it nauseating. All right. Yeah.
We'll ask Brian about it on Wednesday and he can criticize you. Go ahead.
All right. This one is kind of making the rounds on the internet. But do you ever read those vows pieces in the New York Times on Sunday?
Oh, the Bible. What do they call it? The women's sports pages.
Yeah. There was one that was just unbelievably sickening this
week. I'm sure I read it.
It was about a yoga couple found.
Yes, I did.
But I didn't.
She rarely gets upset. She has a few, very few days. She's naturally pretty, so probably doesn't have many. Well, how about this day for maybe a bad day, the day she killed a 5-year-old?
Yes.
And the way they wrote that.
Yes.
When she recounted the incident, you see her calm, philosophical demeanor, her plaintive voice. It was a clear sky, road ahead. I saw a flash of red. The spirit left her body. What are you talking about? You ran down a 5-year-old
kid. She mowed down
a
5-year-old kid.
Wait a second. And what is this in?
This is vows. You don't read it.
This is in the wedding section.
And they always profile
one
couple.
In the style section of the New York Times.
Wait a second. So a writer for the New York Times wrote the first part talking about she never has a bad day.
Yes, they had a picture.
And by the way, she killed a 5-year-old?
Yes. Yeah.
It's making the rounds. It's nauseating.
It is nauseating.
But you know, most of the time they have some really fun ones in there. I love the one where the guy, he's like 89, and he meets his wife to be in the nursing home or something. And he had this line. This is about 5 years ago, and he said, "You know, people don't believe it, but it's like I'm 16 again."
I guess I don't like anything that doesn't have a healthy dose of skepticism. It's
You want to think when you're 18.
She's writing as this flower into plaintive voice. What are you
They have an ombudsperson at the Times anymore.
Yeah.
They do?
Yeah.
A public editor?
Oh, yeah. Her name is Sullivan. Robert Sullivan.
Okay, call her up.
All right, here's another one that really made me sick this week.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that? I missed that.
I mean, James Levine, he screwed us here.
Oh, the BSO.
And I got to tell you, it's like, no, what? Has he got a dossier on everybody who writes in the music industry? You should have seen this fawning piece that the New York Times wrote this. I've never seen it. He conducted a glowing, crisp, buoyant account of Mozart's Così fan tutti. What do you say? It was masterly and natural performance. On and on and on. It's like 8,000 pages going on and on about James Levine.
So what's that about?
And he's in a wheelchair and he's like, how about a reality check?
He's current day J. Edgar Hoover, it appears.
How long was he sick for? For quite some time.
He only conducted like 5 concerts in the 5 years
he was
here.
Yeah.
Is there a backstory to this?
I don't know.
No. I'm talking about with you, not with him. Do you have a thing with him or what?
I always just thought he was overrated. We all heard these grand things about it, and then he never performed. He never got the job done. And there was just this fawning irreverence about how talented he was. How would we know? He never did anything, right?
Remember the story about him killing that bear years ago
when
he was a kid? Okay, what else?
All right, I just have this as a period.
That's sad. We're done?
The end of the sentence.
Well, that's horrible. Go ahead.
Personally, I am never, ever, ever going to read another piece that is written about the Demoulas family in the market basket. I am done. I do not care. I'm done. That's all I have to say.
Is it because you don't understand them or they're so complicated or what?
Hold on. You know, I stopped caring a long time ago because I couldn't figure out which brother was mad at which brother was
who you're rooting for.
Exactly. And explain to people what is the basic Demoulas deal here. They're brothers fighting over the family fortune. Is that basically it?
Control of the company.
And so there's a multi-billion-dollar company and, you know, two brothers.
So they're in court fighting about brother A and brother B. So why is this lingering? This has been going on for 20 years.
Well, it's a huge case, but a lot of money.
Maria Lopez decided the first case when she was a sitting judge.
Which was about 15 years
at
ago,
least.
Right? So why have we not got a denouement here?
Why do we keep writing about it?
I don't know.
She doesn't read it anymore. So how
my eyes glaze over.
Now, this is Demoulas Market Basket?
Yeah.
Okay, because I do know that they have very cheap produce at Demoulas Market Basket.
Oh, my God. The prices
are unbelievable.
Well,
that's another story. You can read about that.
Yeah, but I'm concerned that the settlement may affect the prices of the produce at Market Basket. What do you think?
By the way, if anybody is upset with Emily's decision to not read anymore about, please email us. What's our email, Marjorie? BPRWGBA.
That is correct, Jim.
If you're upset with that. Now, what are you doing tonight on the
Well, we are going to do that Newsweek thing.
Great.
And then we're also going to look at, there are some charges within certain sections of supporters, I should say, of Charlotte Goler Ritchie claimed that she was held to a different standard, that there was sexist reporting, that the focus on her being a woman was, you know, out of whack because, you know. But I've got a take on that, too. I'm not sure that's entirely accurate.
Great.
I think she got a lot of special attention because she was a woman, actually.
She was in the front page of the Herald at least once, maybe
twice.
Well,
I believe you wrote that story.
I did write the story. That's right.
Great.
I did write the story.
Emily, it was a pleasure. Excellent list today.
Thank you.
Good to see you soon.
But don't stop reading the Sunday Style section with the weddings
in
it. Oh, my gosh. Because it is really fun a lot of the time.
Beat the press tonight at 7.
My favorite.
Okay, Emily joins us every Friday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic, and her fantastic list of Emily's, not gripes, but observations. Come back next Friday for more of her observations and watch her every weeknight at 7 o'clock in Greater Boston, including tonight on Beat the Press. Up next, it is the Battle of the Bulger, as in the Boston Globe's Shelley Murphy and the Boston Herald's Peter Galzinis, who both are experts on the Whitey Bulger trial. They face off on the Friday News Quiz next on 89.7 WGBH.
Mel King's contributions to the citizens of Boston are diverse. He's been a passionate advocate for affordable housing, an enthusiastic member of the House Natural Resources Committee, a tireless community organizer, and most famously, a two-time candidate for mayor of Boston. I'm Adam Riley, inviting you to join us for a special conversation with Mel King, Sunday night at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Welch and Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch and Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're actually on the air, Marjorie.
I'm sorry to interrupt your conversation there.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 for our news quiz, as Marjorie termed it, the Battle of the Bulger. That was quite clever. Are Peter Galzinis and Shelley Murphy. Peter is, of course, columnist for the Boston Herald. Shelley, of course, is a reporter for the Metro section of the Boston Globe, also co-author of the great New York Times bestseller, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster, and the manhunt that brought him to justice, which, by the way, just came out in paperback. Hello, Peter. Hello, Shelley.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you guys.
Hello.
So do we have a takeaway from the Whitey Bulger trial? Of course, he is convicted and he's in jail waiting sentencing. What do you think?
I defer to the preeminent Bulger file. I was saying to myself coming over here, I was thinking that if Whitey Bulger were a foreign state and somewhat hostile to the United States, then this lady across the table from me would either be Hillary Clinton or Madeleine Albright. There is no one who knows more about this story and the FBI and its role in it than this lady.
Well, that's very nice, because I know nothing about anything else.
No, it was a great book, though. It was a real page-turner. It was great information and beautifully written with you and Kevin Cullen. You did a great job.
Thank you.
I spent the whole summer reading Bulger books. It was fantastic.
Hey, Shelley.
Excellent.
A story you told me that I don't think many people have heard that I think is worth sharing for a second before we get to the quiz. In a letter, I hope I get this right, but if not, I know you'll correct me. In a letter that Whitey Bulger sent while he was in prison, he referred to you, I believe, as a whore. Is that correct?
That's one of the words,
Can
yes.
you give us the back? There's actually a family connection here that I was shocked to hear. What's the historic connection that he thinks you betrayed?
He thinks I'm a traitor and a slimy woman also.
Why is that?
Well, I grew up in Savin Hill in Dorchester, right next to South Boston. And my father was in the Korean War. He was a paratrooper, and he served in the same unit as Steve Fleming, the rifleman. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't know each other in the service, but when my dad was raising money for the Korean War Memorial at Castle Island in the 80s, he met Fleming. And Fleming prided himself on being this wonderful veteran, you know, as did Whitey. And so he joined this group that my dad was in of, you know, veterans who would gather on weekends, you know, around the country, you know, every few months, whatever, with their wives and their girlfriends. And Fleming would show up. And meanwhile, I was at the Boston Herald at the time writing stories about him, you know, and getting a little nervous that he was getting that close with my father. It was a little scary. Thinking, well, there's a lot of Murphys. Hopefully he doesn't make that connection, you know. But what happened is So this friend of Whitey's who was writing to him since his arrest was helping me and sharing information with me for the book. And he calls me up and he says, oh, I feel terrible. I have this letter from Whitey. He called you a traitor and all these awful things. And he said that he did a favor for my father, that apparently someone was bothering my dad, and he and Flemmy went out and told them to back off or die. And he writes, and the daughter still keeps writing about me.
And you never had, I think you told me your father died before he had an opportunity.
My father died. Now, I never heard, my dad always said to me he would never get involved with these guys. I mean, he knew Flemmy through the military groups, but he would never get involved. You don't want to owe a favor to these people. So I'm kind of skeptical of it. But, I mean, who knows?
Did you also tell me that at a Korean veteran event, I hope I don't get this wrong, that Flemmy told your father that he needed an extra ticket for a friend?
No.
What was it?
No, what actually happened is on the 50th anniversary of the Airborne, there was a huge, you know, party in Washington, a big dinner. General Westmoreland was there. And Flemmy showed up with his good buddy, Jimmy from Southie. Whitey Bulger. And Whitey is there rubbing elbows with General Westmoreland and all these people. And he actually, when he was on the run, they released a photo of Whitey in a white suit. And they cut the person that was with him in the photo out. And the person was the Medal of Honor winner.
That year.
Whitey went to Washington in a white suit?
He did. He looked like a milkman.
I love that.
Or some First Holy Communion gangster.
Okay, so we are talking to Peter Galzinis from the Boston Herald, Shelley Murphy from the Globe, and even though it is the Battle of the Bulger, as Marjorie called it, we have a quiz, too. So would you like to question your co-worker from the Herald, or would you like to talk to your former co-worker now at the Boston Globe? You choose.
Well, since I talk to Peter Galzinis all the time, and I never talk to Shelley Murphy anymore, who used to be, when you sat next to me at the Herald years ago, what was your column? What would you used to do? Ask Shelley?
Oh, no. My first job at the Herald was sound off. People would write in with complaints.
That's right. She used to do sound off.
Consumer like, stuff. I would resolve
it. It was
problems.
Terrific. And then she went on to be like a big time investigative reporter. So there you go. Anyway, okay, you ready, Shelley?
First question.
Who is this man, and why is he among 11 other people in the news this week?
I share the views of the owner of Chick-fil-A. Also, I think that just to be equal and to be democratic, I would not hold someone's ideas, their beliefs, against them in allowing them to have a business in the city.
All right, I told you I know nothing about anything but what he felt.
Okay, I'll give you a hint.
You can only give a little hint.
This guy ran for mayor.
Oh, man. Peter, mouth me the answer.
No, do not even think of it. Okay, the question goes to you, Peter Galzinis. You can steal it.
I saw that. I
remember the Chick-fil-A controversy.
I'm trying to think of...
Okay.
It wasn't Wyatt, was it?
Yes, it was Peter Galzinis.
Excellent.
You know, I wrote a first edition column about Wyatt this week, which didn't make for election night, didn't make the second edition, of course, because it was the election. And I went to where he lives in Roxbury, and I'm asking neighbors, and, you know, they didn't know. Well, I had pictures. And I found this one guy who said his name was Regis. He said, how long you lived here? He said 17 years. Like, next door. And I showed him the picture. He said, no, I don't know who you're talking about. So I think Mr. Wyatt kept a very low profile.
I thought that mayoral scrum that you guys broadcast at Suffolk when they went to him, he looked just like Kenan Thompson in one of those SNL things. You know, the rent is too high.
The rent is too damn high, McMillan.
That deer in the headlights look. Like, what are you looking at me for?
He did pretty well, though, on Tuesday. He got 338 votes, I think. Okay, Peter, you not only have the lead, but you get your first question. You ready?
Oh, okay.
Here is Conan O'Brien, a Brookline kid. What Sunday ritual is Conan O'Brien speaking about in this clip?
Now, sadly for all of us, this Sunday is the very last one. Yeah, from now on, if you want to see psychotic murderers attack each other on Sunday, you'll have to watch the NFL.
Okay. So
that's just the deal.
What is Conan O'Brien speaking about, Peter Galzinis from the Boston?
The end of Breaking Bad.
Yes, indeed.
See, I knew that one. I have to say, I did know that one.
Are you into Breaking Bad?
No, I'm probably the only person in America that
is Whitey Bulger is not in it. Why would you watch Breaking? Wait,
no,
you're not either?
I'm aware of the show, but I'll get into it, I think, after. I'll go back through the old things, but I haven't I don't know why. Maybe it was because of The Wire or Sopranos or whatever that was on Sunday. I never got into it in the beginning.
Yeah, so. I was a big Sopranos watcher. I love Sopranos. Yeah.
And you know what? The new James Gandolfini movie has gotten great reviews.
With Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
I'm very excited about it. So what's the status, Shelley Murphy, of the Whitey Bulger movies? What's the latest? Are you aware?
I saw there was just something I think that was just reported today that that now the Ben Affleck movie is they reported in one of the blogs out in California that he has a new screenplay writer or someone new involved in the script, someone named Aaron Stockard. You may know that name from Gone Baby Gone and The Town.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So he's Matt Damon could be Whitey Bulger?
Matt Damon would be Whitey. And then there's the second, we're sort of, you know, in the item it said that movie by Levinson is that Johnny Depp dropped out of. There's some talk about that one that they could come up with the money to pay Johnny. I don't think Johnny would be a good Whitey. What do you think?
I think at certain points, there are different people who look like him. I think Duvall could probably look like him. I think there was a picture once in the Globe of Malkovich.
John Malkovich.
Who looked a lot like him.
Brilliant.
But you know something? I really wonder if there's enough resonance in Whitey. I mean, the thing about The Sopranos and some of these other people is they were, you know, as characters, they were a little deeper than just being venal and being thugs. And after wading through that trial, you and I and a bunch of other people, and listening to Matarano and listening to some of these people, you know, you're thinking, is this all there is? I mean, this. I mean, it was just, you know, they you know, did horrible things to people, and they made a bunch of money, but. You know, they were lugs.
Out of your mind. There was, read your own columns. Read Shelley's story. There was so much richness in what you wrote, Peter, and what Shelley wrote. You can make a movie out of
that
column.
Some of that had to do with some of the other people, the minor figures.
Right. Well, they're going to be part of the mix,
too,
right?
I think it'd be a great movie. I would love to see it.
You know what? You know what the problem is with you, Peter Gelsenesh? You've grown up in South Boston. Yeah. You're sick of this. I'm not sick of it. I was 26
Well, it's a different, and the town is so different.
Can I tell you something? I wasn't going to disclose this. I've been asked to play Peter Gelsenesh in the movie version. Okay, next question for Shelley Murphy from Marjorie Egan.
This week, an unlikely person did a spot-on impression of former President Bill Clinton. Who is this?
He walked into the Oval Office, and I thought it was a member of his own road crew. He wasn't really dressed right. Actually, I felt like the rock star on that occasion. But together, you know, we did this drop the debt thing, and my God, there's 51 million children going to school in Africa because of the drop the debt thing. That's pretty good. Isn't that right?
This is a hard one, Shelley. Do you have any idea who that is?
I think it really is Bill Clinton.
It really is an incredible imitation.
It's an incredible imitation. Do you have any idea over there, Peter Gelsenesh?
Yes, it is. It's Bono.
How'd you know that?
I spend a lot of time at home.
Oh. You didn't look at my notes, did you?
No, I didn't.
Cheating over there. I had to cover them up.
That was very impressive.
That was very impressive. Okay.
Well, actually, there's a bonus. Not a bonus, but I didn't even notice. The next night on Piers Morgan, our producers tell us,
yes,
Bill Clinton did his impersonation of Bono. Oh, here it is.
I saw that.
I'm Irish, you know. And we Irish, we can imitate anybody. But alas, I've been singing so long and screaming loud at these concerts that I'm hoarse. So I got to be careful with my voice. That's why all my charities only have 3-letter names.
He put on, did you see that?
No.
He put on
that
the glasses. He put on red tinted glasses. Yeah,
that was pretty good.
Yeah. That was good.
Okay, next question. Peter, you ready?
Yeah.
Who is reading this story and why is he reading this story?
I'm covering up my notes here.
I like green eggs and ham.
Oh, no, I know this one.
I do. I like them, Sam I Am. And I would eat them in a boat. And I would eat them with a goat. And I will eat them in the rain. And in the dark and on a train. And in a car and in a tree. They are so good, you see.
Okay, Shelley Murphy says she knows the answer. Unfortunately, it's not her question.
So, Peter
Gelsenesh, it is yours.
It's Ted Cruz doing his filibuster that wasn't.
Exactly.
But, you know, did you see the best part
about
that?
Wait, he doesn't get a beep, beep, beep for that? Doesn't he get a little beep? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry.
Did you see the best part of that was when Stewart took him down no. the next night about
as
the idea that he used this. He used this. This idea of a guy who doesn't like something until he finally tries it as an example of railing against Obamacare.
Well, you heard that he also compared his critics. We mentioned this to Kelly Crossley earlier. Compared his critics and critics of his position on Obamacare to Nazi appeasers standing on the Senate. The same day, we mentioned this as well. The CEO of AIG said in an offhand remark that critics of bankers' bonuses could be equated with lynchers in the deep South. I mean, can you imagine the thoughts like that cross the lips of grown-ups in positions? Or whatever, in any case. Okay, what's the score? I'm afraid to ask after two rounds. So, okay, Shelley, it's 4-0, and Shelley, we're rooting for you. But you said something about her being the greatest Bulger reporter ever. Did you say, want to say that again?
Okay,
she is the... preeminent. Okay.
What is the name of Whitey's brother who was the president of the Senate? Okay,
I know it.
Okay. I think I was supposed to skip a question, but I'm confused.
You're skipping to the Burger King question. Burger King. Next page.
Oh, okay. I'm going to the right place. Okay. Burger King unveiled a new food invention this week. What was it? Here's the CBS This Morning crew talking about it with Michael Moss. Oh, talking with Michael Moss about it. Excuse me.
This is getting a lot of attention. It's already trending on Twitter, for instance. This is a smart business move by Burger King, right?
Absolutely. Although the name itself, I don't know if I'm going to find myself standing in line and wanting to ask for that. But it is a smart move in the sense that they're practicing the fine art of line extension. Good for their bottom line, maybe. Questionable whether what it's going to do for our waistlines.
What a great voice he has.
This is another tough one. You're getting the tough one, Shelley.
No, and it's funny. It wasn't Burger King. I know there was another fast food place that just came out with a healthier form of French fries.
That's it. You win. Oh, she got a point.
It was Burger King.
That's it. Yeah.
Let's call it over. Let's get out of here.
Okay. Do you know what the name of them is, Mr. Smarty Pants over there? Do you know what the names of the Burger King fries are since you spend a lot of time at home?
No.
Satis fries.
That's pretty clever, actually.
Right. Yes, I what's it called? That.
Satis fries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, before I read you
I won't be buying them. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Before I read you
either.
A question, Peter, how does it feel to get a point, Shelley Murphy? What's that? Can you describe the feeling for us, or no?
So
feels good, right?
So did you ever see what you never saw Whitey Bulger until you saw him in the courtroom?
No, I had seen him. I never talked to him, but I had seen him.
Did you go to Santa Monica, by the way?
Didn't you? I did. I was there. Yeah. Yes, I tracked down Miss Iceland, the tipster.
Oh,
I
that's
went all
right.
the way
of
to
course.
Iceland
that's right.
to find her.
How is Iceland? I hear it's great.
It was beautiful, but my daughter kept saying, go to the Blue Lagoon. I'm like, no, I'm like doing surveillance on Miss Iceland's house, you know? And the funny thing about Iceland is they are so much different than this country in terms of they must not have the problem we have with, worrying about your kids and, pedophiles. And myself and a photographer spent all day parked outside a daycare center while we watched this woman's house waiting for her to come home. And not one parent came up and said, who the hell are you and what are you doing here?
Really?
But, Shelley, I interrupted Marjorie's question.
Well, you look like you could have come from Iceland, though.
What is the answer to Marjorie's questions about having seen Whitey Bulger through the years?
No, I did see him, went back in his heyday when he was walking, the dogs over at the park in Southie. I had seen him.
The poodles.
Yes. And I did, I tried to arrange an interview one time through someone, a middle person, who sent back that I was the last effing person he ever wanted to talk to. But when I saw him in court, I thought that he did not look frail, but he looked old and diminished and meek and unintimidating.
He looks like, he struck me as like an old jockey. He looked, for his age, he looked tight, There's not, there isn't an excess pound on him.
Is he legally permitted to do an interview from the federal prison? If he wanted to do an interview with one of you two, which I know he's not dying to do, but if he wanted to, is he permitted to legally?
Well, the thing that's happening right now is he wants to do an interview. And he's trying.
Minutes,
he
right?
wants to do an interview at 60 Minutes, oh. yes.
Does he need court approval to do that?
He needs approval. His lawyer said he needs approval from the defense, the jail, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Deputy U.S. Marshal, since he's still technically in their custody. Well, mm-hmm. he is in their custody, even though he's in a state facility. So,
what do you think?
And
they put
the kibosh on that and said, no, they don't want to, at this point,
they don't want anyone in there. Why? Because an appeal is pending? Or what's the...
you know, they have not said publicly why, but I would guess that they don't want, if they let Whitey do it, why shouldn't any, you know, they don't want to show any special consideration for him. I would think Sarnaev will be looking for someone to come in and do
an
interview.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Would they do it after the sentencing, possibly? Or
well, then he'll go off to, you know, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and they're very difficult. I'm trying to get into it. I mean, it's been done. And if he really wanted to do it, he could certainly push. And I would imagine that 60 Minutes has a lot of cachet. If anyone's going to get in, I would think it would be
But, you know,
them.
If you watch – I don't know if you either guys are masochistic enough to watch, like, MSNBC and those stations on the weekends. All they do are interviews with mass murderers from their prison cells. So I assume – well, maybe every – I don't know if they're different.
A lot of them are in state facilities.
Maybe they are. In any case, okay, Peter, here's your question. I'm sorry. Here's some news from the O.J. Simpson desk right here at WGBH News.
O.J. Simpson has finally been caught red-handed, and no, it's not what you think. The former football star who was serving a 33-year prison sentence was caught stealing from the prison cafeteria. The National Enquirer is reporting that guards saw Simpson trying to hide something underneath his prison clothes as he walked back to his cell after lunch. And after further investigation, they found that he had stashed more than a dozen in his clothes.
This is true, by the way. What did O.J. Simpson steal?
I heard about it this morning. I think it was... A dozen, what, oatmeal cookies?
That is exactly. How great.
Can you believe that?
You should see Peter laughing here.
Look, it's, you know, I've got to uphold the banner of the Herald here, right?
That's right.
So, Peter, did they add time onto his sentence or what?
I didn't know that they included in that thing. Should be a bonus point.
What is it?
He's diabetic.
Yeah, we just heard that in the newsroom.
I didn't know
too.
That. Thank you for that.
Were those sugar-free cookies?
Well, is that because he's gained a lot of weight? Because he has gained a lot of weight.
How do you do that in prison, though? How do you do that in prison?
I don't know. I guess you eat a lot of oatmeal cookies when you have the opportunity. I don't know.
Okay, here's the bonus round, you two.
All right, bonus round.
And by
round.
The way, these questions are worth 17 times as much as the points in the first round, so you can still,
I can still
pull
lose.
This out. Exactly.
I can still really embarrass myself.
Exactly. Okay, you want to go first?
Yeah, since you guys both reported a lot in the Whitey Bulger trial and you know all about it, we're going to ask you about Bulger wheat.
Bulger, too, isn't it?
I don't know.
Is it a Bulger? Bulger,
whoops.
Yes.
Sorry.
Close enough.
Not Bulger wheat, Bulger wheat.
Exactly.
Okay.
Go ahead.
These are multiple choice questions. Question one goes to you, Shelley. These are ridiculously hard questions, so you just have to guess. Here are three stories about a convergence where Whitey Bulger got mixed up with Whitey Bulger. Which among these is not true? A. After Whitey Bulger was arrested, the Huckleberry Cafe and Bakery in Santa Monica featured the Whitey Bulger, a vegan burger made with Bulger wheat, white beans, and Boston lettuce. B. The online game Dragon Cave features a dragon hatchling named Whitey Bulger Carrot. Or C, after Whitey Bulger's arrest, the AARP ran an article on Whitey Bulger, spelling his last name Bulger.
I think it's number two that's not right. I remember when I was out in Santa Monica, you know, retracing Whitey's steps, they were naming all sorts of things after him out there. I'm going to guess number two.
That's wrong. But you know what we're going to do?
Oh, well.
Because you used to work at the Herald, you can guess again. Is it A or C?
tell me A is correct.
A is correct. Give her the points.
Okay.
That is exactly right.
There you go.
Don't complain, Peter. Here's your question, Peter.
I was actually going to go with three, actually.
Well, perfect. Then she got what she deserved. Here you go. Now, Peter, if you get this right, you get a point. If you get it wrong, you lose 12 points. Now, here it is. Which of these... I'm a big fan of Shelley Murphy. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Jim.
Which of these... It's okay. Which of these is a real Paula Deen recipe using Bulger? A... I don't have the answer here, people, so you need to say it in my ear. A, game hens with spicy orange salsa and bulgur pilaf. B, not yo mama's bread pudding made with bulgur. Or C, new fashion turkey meatloaf with bulgur wheat. Which of these is a real Paula Deen recipe using bulgur?
I'll say B.
B would be wrong. Now, here is your chance, Shelley, to tie this baby up. It's either A or C. Is it game hens with spicy orange salsa and bulgur pilaf? Or is it new fashion turkey meatloaf with bulgur wheat? What is the answer?
Oh, God. I'm going to go with the first one.
What's the answer, Joe? Joe, you got it correct.
I would have guessed not my mama first, though, because it sounds like a Paula Deen.
Now, the good news is we don't have enough time for the last question.
Okay. I've never heard of it.
Oh, well.
Now, your book is out in paperback. Is that correct?
It is. It came out this week.
And how's the book doing? And how did it do?
It did great. We debuted on the New York Times bestseller
list. Yeah, they were in the Times bestseller list. I was so jealous.
What's the interest? I mean, beyond our borders. I asked Dan Shaughnessy this question. We wrote the Francona book, and I think he was offended because it was number two on the bestseller list in the New York Times. Do people beyond Boston care about the Whitey Bulger story?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting. People in Ireland, and they actually just translated our book into German.
Is that true?
Yes.
Well, that's
I get it.
Exciting.
Despite what Peter Galzina says over here, who's bored to tears by the entire thing.
No.
You've got the biggest mass murderer. I mean, 20 people. You know, it's an incredible story. And the FBI and the fact that they were so corrupt. I mean, I think it's just a great story. If you haven't read it, you should go out and get it.
It's a great book. It is a great book.
My feeling is that...
What is your
feeling, and I don't know what Charlie thinks. I think
we're out of time here.
I think there's a lot more to the story that is still probably and may never come out that has to do with him... The brothers, his brother.
Amen
and some other
with the brothers. And by the way, you can play Shelley in the movie. Marcia, I just realized it's an Irish thing.
We got the map of Ireland on our faces here.
Shelley Murphy, Peter Gilzin, it's great to see you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm ending.
You are.
Okay.
I'm ending.
You're going to end. Thank you.
Okay, here's the deal. She's the co-author, Shelley Murphy, the New York Times bestseller, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster, and The Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. It is now out in paperback. Peter is a crack and wonderful columnist for the Boston Herald. I'm Marjorie Egan, because you should go first. I am Marjorie Egan.
Actually, I am Jim Brady.
Exactly. Have a wonderful weekend. We will see you Monday at noon. Bye.